Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to Taking Stock on Friday, the 16th of June, 2023. A new podcast. It's a roundup of today's news, views, centered around small microcap end of the market. If I miss something or some news you think I should be covering, please let me know, okay? Let's start off with the indices. FTSE 100, it's up 0.5% to 7,661. Of course, not far of its high, which was 8,014 in February. FTSE AIM All Share, it's at 794. It's up 0.35%, not far of its low, 12-month low. Hit that in October 2022, 775 that was. It's now 794. Currencies, good news for the pound if you're travelling abroad. A pound is at a 12-month high against the dollar. So a pound now buys you $1.27. So it'll buy you, a couple extra beers if you're going to stateside. Looking at today's winners and losers on the small cap, micro cap spectrum there. First of all, is Synergen up 17%. No news on that. Second biggest riser, Gene Drive GDR, up around 15%. And they say Gene Drive multi-partner grant awarded. And we'll cover that later in most red RNSs. Also big riser today is CTA Group. And I've not heard of these before. CTA Automotive Group, up 16%. And that's on their results for the year ended the 31st December. They are a leading designer, developer and supplier of interior components to the global automotive industry. Scott McKenzie, CEO at Automotive, says the group navigated through a turbulent year and is now on an upward trajectory with new awards and customer wins. Big revenue for the market cap, but the margin's obviously quite thin there. Okay, losers today. East Star Resources, EST, is ticker down 30%. And that's from news on their rare earth metallurgical results. I'm not going through the numbers on that, but you can probably guess by the drop, it's not good. Also a loser day, Aptima Group. This was a big riser in the week. Hit sort of 233% up at one point. But there's no news today. But in the week, they did release this news about a partnership with NeuroBio to develop Alzheimer's tests. But they've suggested previously that they do need to raise funds. So maybe that's weighing on the share price. Also down, one of the losers, Valrix, down 12%, conclusion of Hokkaido evaluation agreement. And they say the profile of the product they tested has been found to be unsustainable for further development at this stage, and the evaluation will now cease. Okay, it's time for the most read RNSs on the Vox Markets platform. This is the top three most read RNSs. At three, it's Invinity Energy Systems update on 2022 financial results. And they say as part of the audit process, the cost of fulfilling previously signed contracts has been reviewed, and the company is pleased to announce that it's likely to result in a significant reduction in the provision for contract losses, which was previously recorded. Therefore, Invinity expects the reported gross margin loss as well as loss before tax to be materially better than anticipated. At two, GS Technologies corporate update, the company's stablecoin application for admission to the FCA regulatory sandbox continues to be processed by the FCA. The timeline provided for the FCA is typically indicative and not a fixed date, and the FCA approval process has extended beyond the anticipated timeframe. So essentially, it's taking longer than expected. On a one, it's Gene Drive, multi-partner grant awarded. They announced a participant in a multi-partner grant award from Innovate UK and the UK Government Innovation Accelerator Programme, with funding expected to be made available to further the validation and implementation of the new Gene Drive CYP2C19, that's catchy, ID kit pharmacognogenic test in time for critical clinical setting. Okay, it's time for the top three business stories today. At three, A light and fluffy one, well, not for them, but Spotify's ended its lucrative deal with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex for the couple to produce podcasts. A joint statement from Harry and Meghan's company said the streaming giant said they'd mutually agreed to part ways. Yeah, that's what they always say, don't they? It's not true. Spotify confirmed it was not renewing Meghan's podcast Archetypes, which ran for 12 episodes from August 2022, for a second series. They're not doing that. Archetypes saw Meghan speak to high-profile figures like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, about stereotypes leveled against women. The contract was estimated to be worth $25 million in late 2020. American media are reporting they suggest the royal couple failed to meet the productivity benchmark required by Spotify and therefore wouldn't be receiving the full value of the contract. So my reading that is they haven't produced enough podcasts, essentially. Or if they have, they weren't up to the benchmark. And so Spotify is not renewing contract. But the Duke and Duchess of Sussex say it's been mutually agreed to part ways. Okay, at two, Tesco's reported encouraging early signs that grocery inflation is starting to ease while revealing a leap in sales. This is very odd that they start saying now that prices are coming down after they've been investigated. The large, you know, supermarkets investigated for profiteering on higher prices. Anyway, the UK's largest retailer said there was a slowdown in price growth across the market and is continuing to focus on value for its customers. The company updated on its performance as the food sector faces regulatory scrutiny on its pricing. Yeah. By the way, Tesco is not obliged to give profit figures in its quarter update, but said UK like-for-like sales, excluding fuel, rose 9% to £10.8 billion in the 13 weeks to May 27th. They say food inflation, by the way, has proved among the most stubborn of elements of the cost of living crisis in recent months, with the rate continuing to run above 19%. And at one, this is the most read top business story. The average rate on a new 2-year fixed mortgage has edged closer to the 6% threshold as Nationwide became the latest big lender to push through a significant increase in the cost of its deals. The Builder Society, one of the UK's biggest lenders, said that the changes were being made to ensure it could serve all its customers. One broker said the market was in a vicious circle. Data on wages and rising prices mean markets anticipate inflation and interest rates to stay higher for longer than previously expected. This has led to government borrowing costs, which directly impact mortgage rates, rising to levels as high as last year's mini budget. In fact, above that, if you look at the 2-year bond. But the base rate set by the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is currently, the base rate is 4.5%. It will be reviewed next week and is widely expected to go up for the 13th time in a row. If you've seen an RNS, a company news release today that you think is significant and you'd like me to cover, please let me know. And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yeah, a bit hot and bothered, but apart from that, Justin, I'm not too bad. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know. It's like that. It's this country, dreadful weather. And but 9-10 months a year, the weather doesn't play up. Then we get some nice weather. Ooh, it's a bit too hot.
It's nice. It's good for cricket coaches anyway, if nothing else.
Yeah, I suppose you can't have it perfect, but run about 23-24 is good for me. And then apparently there was a survey a while back. Apparently 23 degrees was seen as the perfect temperature, when we're up to 28-29, it does get a bit sort of, especially in this country. I don't know why. When you're abroad, I suppose you've got swimming pools, you're on holidays.
I was going to say, if you're lucky enough,
all that stuff. Over here we don't have that, and it's the nights, isn't it? That's hard work, you know. But
luckily living next to the sea in Brighton, that's normally not too bad. Actually, that's one of the perks of living in Sussex by the sea, I suppose, as a Yorkshireman in exile.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Okay, well, listen, I heard this week, or was it last week, that there's a lot of worry about, you know, companies going abroad, bigger capital markets, listing in New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, as opposed to the UK, mm-hmm. when they're based in the UK. And then all of a sudden, there's some positive news. I think it was a company called, was it Wee Soda?
Yeah, it's a Turkish soda ash miner and producer. Yeah.
Yeah. So they decided it looked like they were going to list in the UK, London Stock Exchange. So because there's lots of discussion and how you could attract, you know, more companies to the UK stock market, and there's a little bit of worry. There's been a drought in that respect, and people have been going abroad. So, Eva, can you remember some of the companies who have decided to go abroad rather than stay in the UK?
Ferguson has delisted from the London Stock, or has taken its main listing to the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
BHP, the miner, did that. CRH has just voted to do it, the shareholders. Flutter Entertainment, I think, is talking about it. There was somebody was asking Shell if they were thinking about it, and they've said no. And Arm is, I guess, the one that's really started this debate, at least when it comes to initial public offerings. The semiconductor architecture specialist said that it's going to float on the New York Stock Exchange rather than the London Stock Exchange, where its main listing was before it was taken over by SoftBank in 2016. Though I think it did have an ADR listing in the US when it was quoted in London for all the way back in 1998. So those are some of the names that have decided that in BHP's case, Australia, and in the others, America, there are greener pastures. The grass is greener on the other side of the fence or the pond.
Yeah, there's going to be. I just think that they're going to have to do some radical changes now, because once you start to get the momentum there and lots of companies going there, they'll think almost that's due diligence for other companies, saying, well, they've all gone there, so why shouldn't we? What's the point?
Yeah, it can become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, and I guess it's interesting. We sort of. It is, I think, actually domiciled in the UK, and I think the management team are based here, and I think the founder lives here. Mm. Although I think the bulk of the production assets are Turkish, and you know, clearly Turkey has not been on international investors' radar for some time, because President Erdogan has been seen as economically unorthodox by Western standards, and he's, I think they've had five finance ministers in 5 years, and he's been cut, and he's been not too gently nudging finance ministers to cut interest rates when inflation's been galloping away. So I think that they might, the wee sort of management team may have decided that the Istanbul Exchange wasn't the best place to float. Equally, I must point out that the BIST 100 index, the main Turkish stock index, is, I think, at an all-time high because people have been looking for an inflation hedge, I guess, on a domestic basis. I'd love to know what you think of the BIST 100 chart, Justin. It'll probably make your nose bleed. It's so vertiginous. It's gone up about 2.5 times in the last 2 years, I think, mainly because inflation's been absolutely romping away. So, not that I'm an expert on...
BIST 100, is it?
BIST 100, I think. BIST 100.
Oh, wow, look at that.
Look at that, eh? There's a chart for you, mate.
Come back from 2020, it was like at 1,000...
Yeah.
And now it's at 5,500.
That's inflation, baby.
600, almost. Yeah.
There you go. Wow. So I think the Turkish market generally trades on fairly low multiples because of the inflation. Mm. And we sort of said it thought that London was good because the founders here, the domiciles here, and also there are lots of miners on the London Stock Exchange, extractive industries. So there's a good peer group, and it's a good place there for them to list. Now they've changed their mind. Now I'm not privy to the discussions as to why that is. But certainly reading around and being some of the questions I've been asked by journalists, there seems to be mainly a dispute or a debate between management who wanted one price and investors who were prepared to pay another. And in the end, I think, you know, when any investor is looking an initial public offering, and actually it doesn't matter whether it's a new company coming to market or an existing one, the disciplines are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Just doesn't matter. It's... Does it have a good business? Is a management's interest aligned with yours? Do they own stock? What's governance like? Is there a chairman and a CEO separate? Is there good non-executives with a wide range of skills? Yeah. Does it have a decent balance sheet? If you're interested in income, does it pay a dividend? And I think we sort of was planning on paying quite a beefy dividend. And ultimately, what is the valuation like relative to the domestic and international comps? Because the price that you pay is the ultimate arbiter of your investment return. You know, it doesn't matter how good the story is, you can overpay and turn a good company into a bad investment and underpay and turn a bad company into a good one, at least for a while in the latter case.
Yeah.
And the debate seems to have been very much one of valuation, in that we sort of look to be coming in at the high end of the international comps, albeit on an earnings basis, albeit with a beefy yield. And the institutions went, thank you, but no thank you. And I guess that then comes back to, why did they choose London to float rather than Turkey? I guess it was because they felt they could get a better valuation. So if the sellers are getting a better valuation, what's left on the table for the buyers. And that's the key issue. And as somebody who worked for an investment bank for 12 years, and I've worked on a lot of initial public offerings, there's a certain degree of alchemy or black magic to them, in that you're clearly juggling multiple interests. Yeah. The seller wants a price. The buyer wants a price that's going to give them something, you know, to make a return on. They don't want to pay top. Most sellers are smart enough not to want top dollar just to cash out. Mm-hmm. But there's always the odd one. And I don't know where we sort of lies in that. Then clearly the buyers want to pay a lowest price because that gives them maximum, more upside potential and more downside protection. And both parties, plus the offering syndicate, will want there to be an active aftermarket. So again, that speaks against going for the highest price you can get and going for a sensible one to make sure there's lots of interest after the deal.
Yeah.
So that's the alchemy to it. And it's difficult to get the balance. And on this occasion, it seems as if the sellers felt that they weren't getting what they wanted, so they walked. So this now leads us back to that debate that you raised about, is London a bad place to list? And I guess you can say, look, it is clearly disappointing that people aren't coming to London. Stock exchanges exist to raise appropriately priced capital so companies can invest and grow. So it's clearly disappointing that London hasn't been selected. Equally, you know, the bulk of the assets are in Turkey, so it doesn't necessarily have a big knock-on effect upon the British economy per se. And I guess this question of, is it dreadful that London has missed out on IPOs? Here's another chart for you to draw up, Justin. The Renaissance International IPO Exchange Traded Fund. It trades in New York. The Renaissance International IPO ETF.
Wow, and how do you, the Renaissance, let's see if it's that. And is it the Ren Fund? Or was that?
Yeah, the US ticker is IPO, that's for domestic American.
Got it. Renaissance IPO, yeah. Oh, okay.
That's the US one.
Wow.
Now, there's an international one as well.
Yeah.
What do you think of that chart?
Well, do you know what? It's starting to recover, it looks like.
I mean, well, this is the interesting thing.
It's gone from, you know, the Dash for Cash crash, which 2020, down into 21. Then it shot up pretty much to 76. Mm-hmm. In February 2021, it's had a little bit of a dip, and then it tried to get above that a lower high at 68 in November 21. Came all the way down now to 23 in January of this year, but now it's at 32. And it's starting to rally, it seems like.
Yeah. The Renaissance International ticker is IPOS on the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay, yeah.
So that's the international one.
Yeah.
And that's... Okay. Similar, but not showing quite the same degree of recovery.
It's had a bit of a recovery. It's flattened out a bit and gone back down. So it's
So the question, therefore, is, Justin, as a buyer, what have you missed out on as a London investor by not buying those IPOs in the last 3 years?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of downside.
You'd have lost money, right?
Yeah,
on balance.
Yeah.
So what have you missed out on? Why are we wailing and gnashing our teeth about the fact a few bankers can't buy a second Ferrari?
Yeah.
Allow me to weep into my cornflakes.
Yeah, I suppose, I did look through just now the new issues on the London Stock Exchange website, and there's very little.
Skinny.
Yeah, over the last 7 days. There's nothing at all. There's a couple, I think.
No.
I suppose it's endemic of where we're at the moment, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's hard to raise money full stop. Cost of capital is expensive. It's not like,
that's
you know,
the
18
issue.
Months ago. And so that's the bigger issue, the wider issue, isn't it? Everyone's a bit risk averse, you know?
It's where we are in the cycle. Mm. It's where valuations are. And it's where the cost of capital is. And the IPO market is not exactly throbbing everywhere around the world. So London, in that respect, it may have done a bit worse than everywhere else. But equally, you can argue its rules and regs, which may be a bit stricter than everywhere else, have actually served as a worthwhile protection. And we all saw what happened with the US banking crisis in the spring. Where did the origins of that lie? Looser regulation under the Donald. So in that respect, I know London's getting a lot of brickbats, and it is disappointing they're not getting perhaps their share of the IPO pie. But from a buyer's perspective, an investor's perspective, I'm not sure it's the disaster it's being made out to be.
Yeah, no. And the thing is, it's almost, you know, if you say in a buoyant market, let's say you get, you know, say 100 IPOs in a year globally, and so 20% goes to America and so 5% go to the UK, then of course, bring that down to 10 IPOs, then of course it seems like
that's the thing.
Winner. Yeah, exactly.
I guess a bigger issue is that the US is now 60% of global market cap.
Wow, so they get 60 of the 100 IPOs.
Yeah, and when I started my career, the UK was about 12 and now it's about 5.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, they'd get 60, we get 5. Now, reduce that down to 10th, And they get six, and we get sort of one, maybe. So
basically. So that's it. So yeah, it would be, you know, and I think that is part of your function, as we know, of the UK's mix. It's light on tech, it's long on financials, it's long on miners and extractives and commodities, and it's long on consumer staples and utility stodge. Yes. But those are things that, in a different environment, a sustained inflationary environment rather than a low inflation environment, actually might look a little bit better. So the wee sort of thing was actually an interesting test there, in that, you know, mining stocks have actually been doing very well this week, intriguingly. And, you know, it made me wonder, I wonder if actually this London mix that's sort of a little bit more pro-inflation might start to come into its own. Well, we sort of put a bit of a spike in that wheel, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. It's oddly, I've looked back at so many charts recently of companies that IPO'd, and generally all IPO'd at top market, because, of course, money is easy to come by. Everyone thinks the market's going higher. Everyone's willing to invest more and anything.
Yeah.
People get, you know, willing to sort of risk more money, and you get people investing £1 million in ape pictures on NFTs. You realise that's the top of the market.
Everybody likes something new and sparkly. And I think, if anything, I know Peter Lynch, who used to run the Fidelity Magellan Fund with great success for a very long time, he said that IPO stood for it's probably overpriced.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in fact, now, oddly, you won't get many IPOs, but pretty good time to IPO, you know, looking at the charts there.
I think if you're a patient person, I think you'll probably find there'll be people interested. As long as the valuation's sensible, you'll get a sensible aftermarket. And if you help people make money when you want to raise money in the future, they'll be a lot more willing to listen. If you have them over first time round with a silly valuation, the share price dogs out, it's going to be a lot harder to come back in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know what? I'm looking at, like, some of that Renaissance ETF.
Check them out. They're really interesting.
Yeah.
A lot of the international ones, Chinese stuff, by the way, at the moment. So, again, that's possibly why a lot is done pretty badly.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a rolling basket of the last, you know, the biggest IPOs in the world in the last 12 months. So a lot of those have been Chinese. And we know that the Chinese market had a rally and then hasn't done that well because the economy hasn't come out of lockdown as quickly as people thought it might do.
No, but Japan is doing quite well, isn't it?
Not loads of IPOs there yet, but the Japanese market, as we discussed the other week, 33-year high now.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Thanks, everyone. Speak next week.
Take care.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You all right, John?
Yes, I'm good, thank you.
I would like to cover a bit of macro and then a bit of micro news, which is company-specific news. So the macro is about the Fed. Now, they did what's called a hawkish pause, as opposed to last time, which was a dovish raise, which is, you know, counterintuitive. And you're thinking, what are they doing? Why are they pausing? What's going on here? What's your thoughts?
Well, some metals traders I know called it an aggressive skip, which is very funny.
Yeah.
But so they pause rates, but they said they're going to have two more. They're going to raise rates two more times.
They're not,
which is a pretty unusual statement. So we're not going to make life painful for you now, but we are going to attach the electrodes to your proverbials later on. So
I don't think they will. I think they're trying to talk it down. I think they'll start seeing. In fact, the last 2 weeks, I think, is some job numbers coming up from America was not as good. But there's only, weekly is very, it's very volatile, so you can't tell. You need a trend. But I think global growth will deteriorate, or the US growth will deteriorate. I don't think they'll have to. They're trying to talk it down. They're trying to, you know, let the words do the work for them, because there's a lot of companies suffering. I think a lot of people with debt suffering. And I don't think they want to hurt too many people, but they're going to say, we will do it. If you continue to spend and, you know, give good increase in wages, we're going to do it. Well, twice. I don't think they will.
I think you're right there. I think you've hit that right on the head. Retail sales in the States were up in April, May, and yes, that's causing some concern because everyone's worried about sticky inflation. We've certainly got sticky inflation in the UK, and whilst, you know, as somebody with a large mortgage, I quite like a bit of inflation, but that only really works so long as our clients we have more business and we can raise our rates, which, you know, can make life a bit awkward for everybody.
So you say you have a large mortgage, John, and is that fixed? Because I've just seen nationwide prices. I've just mentioned earlier that nationwide up there. They're one of the biggest lenders of upstairs, and we're seeing 2-year fix now, getting close to 6%. What is yours? Fixed for how long? When did you fix it?
Well, look, I don't want to upset anyone, but I am with Nationwide, and I did fix for 10 years at 1.99. So,
wow, that's you're laughing now, Johnny. When did you fix that then? When was that? How long ago was that?
Oh, that was about 18 months ago. So,
That's perfect, John. Wasn't it perfect?
Well, they'll get that if I decide to move in the next 10 years, they'll get their money back. But yeah, I mean, look, the government was kind of indicating to everybody that they should fix. But, you know, these things are easier said than done. It's not possible for lots of people to suddenly change what they're doing. And so, I mean, I feel desperately sorry for people, householders who perhaps thought they might be moving sooner rather than later and didn't want to take that kind of long-term fix out.
Yeah, well, let's because you were mentioning there about inflation and you said, listen, we have become used to very low price on certain goods, white goods or, you know, electronics. And we started, before we hit the record button, you started talking about radio rentals. And I remember one of those in the high street by us. And I think, you know, there's a shop in every high street of radio rentals. And basically people hired TVs, didn't they? Because they were quite expensive to buy.
They were. And when I was a kid, yeah, and I didn't know anyone who had the money to buy a TV. You know, this was in the days of black and white. Mm. And I remember when colour came in, but it was always a rental. And rentals was a huge business.
Yeah.
Nobody ever considered going out and buying a TV. Not in our street, anyway.
Yeah. I wonder when that. It's odd, isn't it? Why did also maybe psychological? Because there must have been a time when radio rentals, the business model, started failing because people could start buying tellies and they realised, hang on a sec, doesn't make any sense. If I rent that TV, I've paid for one or paid for two pretty much within 12 months and I hold it. So there must have been a time when people started realising that the cost of these goods are coming down. And it all has, isn't it? Largely due to sort of, I mean, you know, mass production, you know, more efficiency on mining, maybe goods and producing and production lines and all that stuff. So, but are we at the point now where goods are never going to get any cheaper because they've been as cheap as they can get? And we'll have to, you know, no, surely not. Surely things will get more efficient anyway going forward and things will get even more cheap, won't they?
Well, at some stage, I reckon there'll be some more inflation in goods, and we saw that when the COVID lockdowns came out, you know, finished, people rushed out and bought things. There was particularly inflation in the service sector when restaurants and pubs and bars just whacked up their rates. But for goods, what we're seeing now is that yes, people were busy buying laptops and stuff in lockdowns, and then they bought a bit more afterwards. But China is now struggling to sell a lot of goods, and so prices will come down. And that actually can start to become deflationary at some point. I mean, I don't think the West is about to see deflation. I don't think the Fed's worried about that just yet. But they could start to get worried about it. And I think the Chinese probably ought to start having some concern, because there is a report on one of the news wires talking about a chap in Beijing bought a 2-bedroom apartment in Hebei for $2,500, and he said flats were being sold like cabbages.
Well, I've seen incentives, you know, about what's happening at the moment, incentives for people in China, I think it was, to buy these flats. And I think they're offering like gold or all kinds of incentives to buy flats to get the, stimulate the economy again. So we may be seeing, there's a trouble here, that the Fed, like we said, largely behind on the raising of interest rates. They could have gone, if they started earlier, they could have gone a lot smoother, you know, for longer. But they've raised them quite quickly, and central banks over here and Europe. But now, I do feel like we are behind the curve again. They are lagging. They are looking. There's been this phrase: they are driving, looking in the rearview mirror at data that's out of date. You know, so the real data they should be looking at. I mean, look at commodities, for example. That's real time data that will feed in. That will feed into prices going down the line. So I have to take that on board. You know, of real life data. I mean, if you look at all, I'm just looking now at all commodity prices. You know, from oil to copper, everything. Not at their highs. You know, wheat, corn. They are at their lows. You know, so They have to understand that. It takes a while to feed in. But do they understand the lag effect this is going to have? And I'm worried that, you know, we'll have a mass slowing down of the economy. Layoffs will happen. Of course, that will affect wage growth and all that, of course, negatively, which they're worried about. But they're not seeing that. They're not looking ahead. They're not looking down the road, like 200 yards. They're looking behind them, you know? So that could happen. Disinflation could happen. You know, sort of, that's what I'm worried about. And I think if you look at the inverted yield curve, it's never been as inverted. Never. In the last 40-odd years, which is relevant to now, I suppose, it's never been as inverted, and yet it's predicted the last 10 recessions accurately since 1955. So that's what's worrying me a little bit, you know?
Yes, well, the thing about these indicators is they work in certain environments and not in others, and hindsight is always a wonderful thing. And perhaps when we look back at the yield curve, we'll say, oh, well, that was that. It wasn't the time for that recession. And who knows? Maybe we head into a recession. Maybe we don't. At the moment, we seem to be skirting. We seem to have growth. In fact, the UK has growth and Europe is still slowing down. Now, that's really down to the Ukraine situation more than anything else, which is the big wild card. There's always something out there. There's always a wild swan event that changes the global landscape.
A wild swan, I like that. It's a black swan, you mean?
Or maybe a black swan event, yes.
And the actual wild swan is really wild, that swan is. No, but what I was saying is, John, if I'd, for example, if you give me a dart, right, and I basically had to throw it at 20 on the scoreboard, and I've done it 10 times in a row, you know, what's my chance of doing it the next once? Because that's what the inverted yield curve has done. It's predicted the last 10 recessions. And yet, it's not only inverted now, it's inverted at a larger inversion than it ever has been, pretty much in the last 40 years, since 1955, whatever. So that is what my worry is. You know, the track record of the yield curve, the inversion, is very accurate. You know. So are you saying now, in 10 times now, this last one is not going to be right? I don't know. I prefer to put my faith in that rather than say central bankers will listen, a bit biased, and they're not as good, and they haven't been around as long as the yield curve. So, you know, I think that's more accurate predictor than they are, you know?
Justin, I know a great economist who's predicted 12 out of the last 3 recessions.
Exactly. Yeah, I know, exactly. You find, central banks haven't been right on inflation at all. Even in the last year or so, they've been wrong. So, you know, what hope do we hold for that? But that's why I've got a decent amount of cash pile in my portfolio. And I'm determined not to get involved because I think there's something not quite right. There's something not quite right here. You know, when you talk about a historic inversion of the yield curve, that's telling you something. It is.
Well, there's a great expression from Asterix and Obelix, and it says the sky has not yet fallen on her heads, because, of course, back in the ancient Gallic lands, they were worried that the sky would fall in on their heads and genuinely worried of it, but it never quite happened. Mm-hmm. And so economists are always looking around for these black swan events or, you know, what might go horribly wrong, the Chinese local authority debt, that sort of thing. Sure. And so as far as I'm concerned, the sky hasn't fallen on our heads yet, and I don't think it's about to. But we do have a horrendous war going on in Ukraine at the moment, and that is draining a lot of finance out of the West. I mean, we're talking billions or, you know, tens of billions of dollars being pledged by European nations and the US on a regular basis to fight this war and sort out the Russians. And personally, I think, well, hopefully when this is all over and done with, and hopefully the Russians have been put back in their box, that actually the world will be a safer and much better and much more agreeable place to work in.
Yeah, yeah. What they need to do, all the governments of the world that oppose Vladimir Putin need to put up 10 million quid each for the assassination of Putin. it'll get to 100 million. And even the closest ally to Putin, who's got access to... Trump is, they have to get past his table first. But, you know, his long table, you'll see him coming, you know, that long table. You scramble up over the table. That's about a 100-yard table they've got to get past. But you know, sooner or later, someone will see to him. Or even just lock him up. You know, 100 million, just lock him up or something. You know, or put him in a straitjacket or anything. Just do anything. Just get him off the scene. Because that's the problem now. I mean, because 100 million, you know, you'd be surprised how unloyal loyal followers are when you offer them $100 million, you know. Let's talk about some individual companies, John. You did say, have I mentioned Celsius recently? Yes, you have, on the last three podcasts.
Yes.
What's happening with Celsius now?
Well, they're edging closer to getting their mining license on the MCB copper project in the Philippines. They've received their environmental compliance certificate, which is a very important step on the way to that, what's called the MPSA, the Mineral Production Sharing Agreement. And as we know, that they are that a group called Silvercorp has already put $5 million into the company, and it's offered to buy the MCB project in effect for $56 million. That's £30 million. So that's great. And there's two more perfectly good projects within the Celsius portfolio. So I think, you know, shareholders are likely to, well, shareholders hopefully at the end of the day will get rewarded very nicely. They'll get 90% Silvercorp shares and 10% cash out of that deal. Plus, they get to continue to invest in a company with another project, another copper project in the Philippines, and something else in Namibia. So, I think that's that looks like the best IPO in London on the AIM market this year, by some margin.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. There's not a lot of competition, is there? Just been talking about IPOs, Russ Mould, and there's been very little. Like, we've gone past in the last 7 days of new issues. On the London Stock Exchange, none, pretty much. Or there's two, most of them are bonds. There's hardly any equity there at all. So there's not a lot of competition, but it's good that it's gone up, I suppose. You know.
Well, the press has been full of this Turkish soda ash deal.
Yeah, about Russia, yeah. But do you know what? We and Russ looked at the actually IPO index in the US, and essentially the last 18 months anyway, if you've taken part in an IPO, there's a good chance you'll have lost money. So what is London missing out on? You know. But anyway, what's your thoughts on the wee soda?
Well, who wants to buy soda ash? I mean, it's a chemical product. It's not really a mining product.
Yeah.
I just don't think the market's interested in products like that. I think if you have a chemical product that goes into batteries, into the lithium-ion batteries, that becomes something rather interesting and important. Mm. But like high purity alumina, for example, which goes on the separator plate between the anode and the cathode, that's a good one. And all of the materials that go into those batteries, we can see enormous growth in demand for those materials, and it's just a question of what particular battery chemistry will dominate going forwards. And what we're sure of is that lithium will remain a dominant material because it's very lightweight. Mm-hmm. And everything that you can replace lithium with is much heavier, so why would you do that?
Well, but more efficient, though. Yeah. I've been reading about vanadium redox batteries. Now, they've got a 25-year life cycle. They deteriorate, unlike lithium, and now the cost of storage for that will be below lithium very soon. And it also is safe. There's no fire problems with vanadium. So that's very interesting as well. And in fact, you're a big fan of Bushveld, and they're into vanadium, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And vanadium redox batteries are a really good solution.
Yeah.
The problem is that the cost of vanadium is higher than the equivalent cost for installing lithium-ion batteries for grid use.
It's coming down. It's massively coming down. In fact, do you know what? Invinity, actually, Energy Systems, they've got a new V3 battery coming out. And they're looking at the basically the cost of storage, because that's what it's about, isn't it? If you have to change the lithium-ion battery every 5 years because it's discharging and not getting efficient, you have to replace it in 5 years. The cost of storage over like a 25, 34-year life cycle, which is what big companies need to do, vanadium now is now below that. I think it was like $113 versus $111 for vanadium, cheaper than lithium. So over the longer term, it's actually proving to be more efficient. So and also it's more prevalent, isn't it? Vanadium is like you know, a side shoot where you're normally looking for something else, and when you get vanadium out of the ground, but it's more prevalent than copper, isn't it? So,
well, I do hope the big utilities go for the vanadium batteries, but unfortunately, the way the financing works at the moment, I think they keep installing lithium ion.
Yeah.
And there's certain advantages to lithium ion because the batteries kick in very much quicker. It's not much quicker, but when it comes to running a grid, you do want a battery to come in within nanoseconds rather than several seconds, and that's a big difference to these guys.
Yeah, no, there is the efficiency apparently as well. Lithium ion is a bit better, about 95% efficiency.
Yes,
vanadium redox is about 75% whatever. But I was talking to the CEO actually, Infinity Energy Systems, and he was saying, but that isn't an issue right now because we're wasting so much that's not being stored. We've got all these renewables creating electricity. A lot of it is not being stored at all. So it's not like, you know, we're worrying about the efficiency. You've got to turn around very quickly because we're wasting so much anyway, you know. So, so that's very interesting. Anyway, so let's go on to Cornish Metals. What's happening there, John?
Yeah, so they gave the market an update. They've been, they're pumping out water from the South Crofty mine. Got two submersible pumps in there. They were really just updating us. They've also got some other exploration going on, because one of the criticisms of Cornish Metals is that they don't have enough of a resource at the mine. But having actually worked as a young training mining engineer at the time in the South Crofty mine, we know that there's always a certain amount of ore left in the stopes that's ready to access. When the water levels are down to those points, they'll be able to get in there and just start extracting straight away. So I'm looking forward to the company moving forwards, financing the processing plant, and also looking to bring in new resources from the Carn Brae discovery, which is about a kilometre from the existing workings, and from the Wheal Maid discovery that they had a while ago. And I think both of those are going to contribute important sources of high-grade supply going forwards. And that's important because it'll give Cornish Metals a long life, I'm sure of that, and a good future. Just so long as tin prices stay something over $20,000 a ton.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, as far as water concerns, have you seen already? There's been hosepipe bans coming in this month. We've had has it been the wettest March and May or something on record? And then or the start of May or March, and then April. I think it's wettest April around. And then we've had, 3 weeks of sun, and now we've got hosepipe bans coming in for Sussex and, where is it, Kent, I think it is, on 26. So that'll help, water levels. But anyway, I don't know if it's connected. Savannah Resources, SAV, what's that mean, John?
They have a new scoping study that's come out. In fact, things are moving ahead at Savannah, and I'm not the lead analyst on this. Our analyst Sergey Ravisky is running this, but I've never seen him so enthusiastic about a stock. Never in the last 15 years that I've worked with him have I seen him really quite so ebullient. And he's got a target price of, I think, 22p on this, 22.6, and it's only 5p at the moment. That's very un-Sergey-like. The NPV, 953 million, that's versus a market cap of 83, and IRR, internal rate of return, of 77%. They're very good numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's on a very conservative price assumption. So of $1,464 a ton, and the lithium spodumene price today is $4,090. So that is quite. I think that's we're quite happy with the company using that price for its numbers. So Savannah is looking very good. It's all about getting the mining license in Portugal, but surely that will come.
Surely, John.
Surely.
Clean green spodumene. Marvellous stuff, John. Thanks. Anything else? That's about it. I think plenty there, wasn't there? Plenty for people to be chewing on.
Yes, that's certainly enough for investors to chew on for now.
Marvellous stuff. Johnny, speaking next to Wiki.
Thank you, Justin. See you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, PayLater, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.